and welcome. You are listening to Gore and Guilty Podcast. I'm Greg.
And I'm Georgia.
And today is a Georgia episode, and we're going to be talking about a very mysterious case, or at least that's my understanding, Georgia.
Yes, so today we're going to be talking about a 16-year-old girl that was abducted and murdered. But unfortunately, we won't be getting closure on this one because it is still unsolved. But yes.
Ooh, those ones always hurt, always hurt.
This one really hurts.
I'm looking forward to hearing the details. But before we jump into it, some interesting things to announce and say and do. So firstly, happy Easter to you, Georgia.
Yes,
happy Easter to all the people listening.
Happy Easter. Yeah, happy Easter, everyone. Hope you had a lovely day and ate lots of chocolate eggs, because, yes.
You know, I haven't eaten a chocolate egg yet. How poor is that from me?
Yeah, I have had one, I must say.
I'm on it. As soon as I get back to Gloucester, where I'm hoping a lot of my relatives have been so kind as to have bought me an egg.
If not, this is the announcement to get Greg some Easter eggs before he visits.
This is your last minute announcement while there's still time. You can still get them online, guys. So yeah, hopefully get some eggs. And then the other interesting thing is that we're bringing back questions now. We're going to start doing some questions at the beginning, back by popular demand. Maybe just one a week. We'll do a pick and we'll both answer, and then we will go into the episode like normal.
Yeah, I think so. They were good fun.
That's the plan. Yeah, I don't know why we stopped doing them, really. It wasn't intentional. But before we do a specific question, Georgia, how are you doing? I heard you spent yesterday climbing a hill.
I did, yes. We went to the Bracken Beacons and went up Penivan, which was, really good. We missed the rain, which was great. There was quite a few people there. Obviously, it was Easter Sunday, so lots of people out doing their afternoon walks, probably preparing for their Sunday roasts, if not it's the walk after it. But it was lovely. And we saw each other as well on Friday. So you saw some comedy, which was very good.
We did.
Yeah, we had a great time.
We did. We had many beverages. Maybe one too many. But it was a fun evening. Some good photos taken that we should probably share as well. And it was fun. I enjoyed myself.
Yeah, same. How about you? How was your Easter?
Yeah, my Easter's been interesting, I suppose. I've not really done a huge amount. No Easter egg hunts here. I went out last night, had one too many espresso martinis, and that's maybe adding to the raspiness of my voice. Also, for people wondering, I'm not actually sure if it's noticeable. In real life, it definitely is. Like, my voice is sounding a bit huskier than normal.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not me finally going through puberty. It's just a cough that has been causing me grief for weeks now. Yeah, lingering cough. Yeah. And you know when you're just so fed up of an illness that you just kind of just try to forget about it and move on with your life and just do all your usual bad habits? That's kind of what I'm doing at the moment, and it's definitely probably just prolonging this. Hopefully my voice won't permanently be this raspy. But hey-ho.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, you get over it soon.
Fingers crossed, eh? All right, question. Georgia, number between 1 and 55, what do you reckon?
48.
48, okay. Interesting. What is the most life-changing decision you've ever made on a whim? Can you imagine what you'll... Actually, let's just do that, yeah. What is the most life-changing decision you've ever made on a whim?
Okay.
That's a really good question. That's a really good question.
Well, the first one that comes to mind is probably when I was at uni. I was doing criminology and criminal justice degree at the time. And we all used to, I've maybe said this story before, but we all used to watch David Attenborough documentaries as like a massive group. There's probably about 15 of us all hushing each other. And no one was allowed to speak when David was speaking. And after that, we were all like talking about it, and I was sharing some facts and things like that. And someone said, "Why are you doing criminology and criminal justice? Why aren't you doing some sort of like geography degree?" And sure enough, by the next week, I had changed my degree and I ended up doing physical earth science. And that has changed my life because, haven't looked back really. But still, obviously, criminology is close heart, like part of my heart as we've got this podcast together. But that's probably one of those whim decisions, and turned out for the best.
Happy days. Nice. That's a good answer. That's a really good answer. I also remember that. I remember that decision being made in real time.
Yeah. It's like, I'm doing it, guys. I'm doing it. Halfway through my degree. Let's switch it up. But yeah. Nice. What about you?
I have a tremendous habit of making really big decisions on a whim. Like, grew my hair for years. Pretty much woke up one morning and was just like, I need to get this cut today. Cut it. But the one that jumps out to me is I, for people that aren't aware, in the UK you get grades at your A level and that decides what university you're going to.
Yes.
But you have to pick two universities and they give you a conditional offer where they say, okay, if you get AAB or AAA or whatever, then you will get an offer to come to our university.
Yeah.
Now, in classic Greg fashion, I left it to the last minute to decide. But I thought I'd decided in my head, I thought I was going to put Cardiff first and Plymouth second. And then with about 3 hours to go on the deadline, I realised that I'd got in my head the wrong offer from Cardiff. I thought they were offering me ABB. They're actually offering me AAB.
Ooh.
And I was like, I'm never going to get that. So on a whim, I just picked Swansea. That was my new first choice. There was no thought to it. I just went, Swansea will do. And without that whimsical decision, then there would be no Goran Gilty. I never would have met Georgia.
Yes.
Maybe I'd still be living in Cardiff, I suppose. I've ended up here anyway. But
yeah.
That was possibly a life-changing decision.
That was a big decision. Oh, that's amazing. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was a fun one.
Good questions.
Good question. Okay, we're back with... questions are back with a bang. Okay. Shall we jump into the case?
Yeah, let's do it. So today, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to be discussing the case of Molly Bish. And it's about a 16-year-old girl who was abducted and murdered. It's one of those cases that I remember hearing about a few years ago, and it really stuck with me. Whether it's like the details that kind of related, or just the mystery of it, something doesn't make sense in the way that I don't understand why it hasn't been solved. And unfortunately, as you guys now know, it is an unsolved case, so we aren't going to get the closure that we really, really want.
Okay, interesting.
So Molly Bish was born in Warren in Worcester County, Massachusetts, USA, on the 2nd of August 1983. Her parents were Maggie and John, and she had some siblings. At the time of her disappearance, she was 16, and she was a lifeguard. Lifeguarding was her first ever job, and what's terribly sad, it was her 8th day into the job, her first ever job, when she went missing, and her brother had worked the same post at lifeguarding for 3 years prior, so she knew the area, it'd been safe with him, and then suddenly, on her 8th day, she goes missing.
8 days, that's really unfortunate, isn't it? Barely even started.
And what's also sad is the fact that the family had moved from Detroit to Warren because of an awful experience that they'd had in their own neighbourhood. Within the neighbourhood, a young woman was abducted and murdered while she was walking home from work. So the Bish family decided to move to Warren, a small rural community, as they believed it would be safer. And then it sort of happened to Molly.
That poor family.
During the summer of 2000, Molly sets off that morning to go and lifeguard at the Commons Pond in Warren. The pond is pretty quiet, it's relatively isolated, it's surrounded by woods. It would be, as I can picture it, it's like a lake, and then they get sand deposits to kind of make like a beachy bank where people can enjoy the water, swim around, like children can swim there. It's very family orientated, and it just seems really tranquil and lovely. So on the 27th of June, Maggie, Molly's mother, drove Molly to the Commons Pond where she was meant to work that day, and they arrive around 10 a.m. She gets dropped off near the lifeguarding station, and that is the last time that anybody sees Molly alive. A few hours later, after Maggie dropped her off, the police called the Bish family to inform them that no one had been monitoring the water from Molly's station all day. and all of her belongings had been left. So the family rush to the scene and they find Molly's flip-flops, the chair, the first aid kit, her radio and her lunch all left unattended, and there was no sign of Molly.
Oh God. Flip-flops. Her flip-flops were left.
Yeah, her shoes were gone.
That's interesting. Had she got in the water then, maybe?
I don't know whether, because it's, the chair that she sits on is one of those like generic lifeguarding chairs where you go up the steps a little bit and you sit up high and watch the bank and the water. So whether she normally just flipped them off and just she sits there. But wherever she's gone, she obviously hasn't got all her belongings, her lunch. It's as if, like, you know, either if she went off, she was coming back quite quickly, or it wasn't like she didn't intend to be leaving, you know, as in abducted. Super strange.
Hmm. Yeah, very strange.
So families during the day had noticed that there was no lifeguard at, like, the spot, and then it kind of spiraled into people going, yeah, actually, where is Molly? At first, the police were, this was probably about an hour into her shift, where the police were informed, and they went, oh, she's probably 16, so she, you know, she's probably with her friends. And then by 1 o'clock, the police went, no, actually, let's inform the family. So they informed the family straight away, which then cooperated. This is not like Molly. She wouldn't leave her post. She's dedicated to her job. And then they really quickly spiraled it into, we think she's being abducted.
Oh, God.
So there's no signs of struggle at the scene of the crime. As I said, the police and family quickly agreed that she'd been abducted.
I wonder why.
Yeah, it's maybe because it was so...
I wonder why they...
isolated. I don't... Like, at first, I watched this one clip where they said, we wondered whether she'd drowned in the water, and then they started putting divers in straight away and searching. And I also watched this one clip of Maggie Bish, the mother, speak about how at first the police didn't really know what to do. It was kind of like a scramble where they, you know, some were in the water, some were in the woods and talking to people. And it was all like they didn't really know where to start, and it wasn't kind of organised at first. But then quickly came to that conclusion. It's not like her to just leave.
Yeah, because my first thought would be she's, you know, in the water.
Yeah.
Especially if there's no sign of struggle.
Yeah.
Because if there was a sign of struggle, you'd be like, okay, this person hasn't got in the water. They've encountered some sort of hardship and someone's done something sinister.
Yeah.
But the fact that there's no struggle and they've reached that conclusion so quickly, that's quite interesting, I think.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. And I mean, it's fantastic, really, for the police to have worked so quickly into that. Because sometimes we hear cases where it takes at least 48 hours, 72, and, you know, that's when the time is just so critical to try and piece together what's happened and find the information before it's gone. So in that respect, it's really good that they've taken this so seriously and they're getting all the teams out. And it has gone down in history as the state of Massachusetts, as one of the most expensive and largest searches for a missing person. So they just took it straight up to that level, which was great.
That's interesting, yeah.
On the 26th of June, so the day before of her disappearance, her mother Maggie noticed a suspicious-looking man in the car park where Molly's lifeguarding post was. He had a moustache and he was sat in a white car. Maggie looked at him, but he didn't acknowledge her, and it really made Maggie feel so, so uncomfortable. Like, he was very suspicious and really creepy.
The day that Molly disappeared, you said?
The day before. So this, he was there the day before, yeah, in the car park. And due to this man making Maggie feel really uncomfortable, she escorted Molly down to her post that day. And when she walked back, she hoped the man was gone. However, when she walked back to her car, the guy was still there. And at this point, they make eye contact with each other. Maggie, the mum, she stares him down and he looks straight back at her without like batting an eyelid. Like, he, as she describes, is pretty bold. And so she goes, right, okay, I'm gonna pretend to get my purse up my bag and like hover around until he leaves. I'm not leaving until he's gone because he's giving me bad vibes. And as she goes into her car, she waits there for several minutes and then he finally leaves. But she said the whole time she was like, just leave, you've got a job, you know, just go, why are you here? Why are you in this car park? And she said she turned into this, quote, a mother bear, where she was just like, get this guy out of the car park. So straight away, she said that bad vibes from this person. Mm. So he disappears the day before. And on the day of the disappearance, Maggie didn't see the guy or the car. However, as I mentioned before, they have a sandy bank and they had the sand disposer, I suppose, like there, like a massive lorry filled with sand. And he's just sat there working and putting the sand back onto the beach. And when he was asked, have you seen a man with a mustache looking like this and has a white car? He said that he'd seen him minutes before Maggie and Molly arrived at the park car park. So he was in the area. There was other witnesses as well that said that his car had been parked in the cemetery, which was only a short path to the beach where Molly was working. So multiple accounts of this man being in the area on the day of Molly's disappearance.
Okay, that's interesting.
Really interesting and very creepy. So the Bish family set up a website to publicise the case straight away. They managed to get an email chain going to raise awareness in hope that someone will say something if they spot Molly. And over 30,000 people received an email with this information. So they instantly went straight to work and really got their voices out there. In 2001, Maggie got in touch with a sketch artist who was well known for being able to produce these sketches just from a description. And Maggie decided to do this with him to get together an image of the man that she saw. And I mean, she spent a lot of seconds staring this guy down, so she got a really clear image of what this man looked like. They spent 9 hours putting together this sketch to make sure that it was just right. They made two photos in the end, one with the man holding a cigarette and one without. And there was places online where I noticed that apparently he had quite a like distinctive way of holding a cigarette, where his like two fingers were really extended straight, and then the rest of his hands was kind of like in. So it was really prominent, just a two-finger cigarette. So he was sat in his car smoking when she saw him. So he had dark brown hair, dark eyes, roughly around 50 years old, and thought to be a heavy smoker. However, with all of this effort and, you know, putting together this image that was then spread around everywhere, nothing came of it. In autumn 2002, a hunter was in the woods on Whiskey Hill in Palmer when he spotted a torn up blue swimsuit. Thinking it was odd but not alarmed, several months later, in May 2003, he spoke to Tim McGuigan, who contacted the police about this. So nearly 3 years after Molly's disappearance, a search began in this small section of the woods for Molly. And on the 9th of June 2003, Molly's body was found 5 miles away from her home. The exact cause of death was never determined. However, the law enforcement agreed that it was murder, and that she was had been buried in these woods. There was over $100,000 for information leading to an arrest that had been put up at this point. So Molly has been found, she was murdered, and so they're just trying to piece together what happened in between, and especially when she was found so close to the family's home. It's just so terribly sad.
That's really sad.
In 2005, 5 years on, a Connecticut resident was briefly under investigation in connection with the case. They had previously been charged for attempted kidnap in Connecticut. However, this didn't go anywhere, so this one was dropped. So then, in 2007, so 7 years on, sex offender Robert Berno was questioned. He had previously attempted to abduct and assault a jogger in Brimfield, which is only a few miles from Warren and the pond, and he matched the same description as Maggie recalled. And again, this also didn't go anywhere.
I wonder if they offered these guys a cigarette to see if they had the same smoking style.
That would be a great idea, yeah. If they fit the description, I guess they must smoke. And yeah, that would be a great one. Especially off guard, just casually.
Yeah, like, can I offer you a cigarette in the interview? Yeah.
That'd be a good one. I wonder. So in 2009, Rodney Stanger was on the police radar. He was a Florida resident who had been convicted for murdering his girlfriend of 20 years, Crystal Morrison. They both lived in Southbridge, Massachusetts, which was only a few miles from Warren, and both of them had lived there for over 20 years. Rodney moved to Florida 1 year after Molly's murder, which it's been noted that was quite unusual for someone that had stayed there for so long and then suddenly decided to up and leave and go back to where he was from, which was Florida. And Crystal's sister actually reported this to the police, so she definitely felt like this was important.
Mm.
They lived in a building which was really close to where Molly took her lifeguarding training and where she received her certificates. So there is a chance that he was able to recognise Molly. It was known that Rodney would drive a white car. So if you remember, that was similar to the car that Maggie saw.
Mm-hmm.
He also looked similar to the man that Maggie saw as well. So it kind of fits the bill. And one final point is that he knew the area really well. He used to fish and hunt in the area. So again, he has that experience.
Probably would have needed someone to know the area really well to get away with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he fished and he hunted in the area, and also it was known that he was in the area at the time of her disappearance. A final point as well, before he murdered Crystal had told many people that he was responsible and involved in many murders in Massachusetts. So that was also like another little key point. Mm. However, he was not charged for Molly's murder.
I guess it was probably quite hard to connect these people with such a lack of evidence.
I know, that's the really sad bit, because there is just really minimal evidence. I mean, the fact that they don't exactly know how Molly died as well, there's so many pieces missing.
Yeah.
During the questioning of Rodney and Molly's case, the police decided to investigate his connection to another murder, Holly Pierian, who was murdered in 1993 and went missing in Sturbridge. He was not charged for this case either. However, there are some similar spooky occurrences between this case and Molly's. When Holly went missing in 1993, Holly and Molly were at the same age. Molly had actually written to Holly's family a letter of hope. This happened 7 years before Molly's murder. So she is age 10 and she writes a letter, and there's a small snippet from that letter, which I'll read, which is, quote, "I'm very sorry. I wish I could make it up to you. Holly is a very pretty girl. She's almost as tall as me. I wish I knew Holly and I hope they find her." So it just kind of also shows the amount of empathy and just loveliness Molly was to try and reach out to this family to give them some hope.
Hmm. Such a small world as well.
Hmm, exactly. Holly was found in the wooded area of Hampton County. So in 2012, forensic evidence has pointed law enforcement to David Pouliot as a person of interest in the Holly case. And David has now died in 2003, so...
may never get answers there then.
Yeah, again, it's just... done. So you'll find it, that kind of is a recurring theme in this, where you kind of are on a trail, you think you've got somewhere, and then the criminal passes away or dies before you can get any answers or confirmation that this is, you know, is there a connection?
Mm.
2011, Gerald Battistoni was a person of interest in the Molly Bish case by a private detective, Dan Malley. Gerald was an informant for the Eastern Hampton County Narcotics Task Force. So he was known to the police and was working with them. He'd served time for several rapes of teenage girls in the early 1990s, and one of his rape victims lived very close to the pond where Molly worked. During one of his prison stints, when the press released that he was a suspect in Molly and Holly's case, he attempted suicide, which was then noted.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was quite a real jerk reaction. I mean, he's committed some heinous crimes, but to be pinpointed as a prime suspect in the Molly and Holly case, his reaction was that.
Mm.
Moreover, he did fit the description of the man that Maggie saw at the pond and was in the area at the time of her disappearance. Dan Malley, the private detective, and the Bish family requested for the DNA of Gerald to be taken and compared. The Massachusetts State Police sent the DNA to Texas in 2016 and an enhanced DNA testing would be issued for 24 pieces of evidence. However, they are yet to be tested, and so we haven't got any conclusions on that, and Gerald has now died in November 2014, so obviously can't confirm anything either. In 2017, law enforcement said that they had received some compelling information in West Brookfield Campground. The car, which was thought to have been used to abduct Molly in, was found and buried, allegedly. Apparently, there was a man that was living on the campground during the time of Molly's disappearance and owned a white Buick, which was similar to the one witnesses saw at the time. A witness said that during the time of the disappearance, this man had said to him, quote, "Something bad has happened," and that, quote, "I was in the woods all night." He came back with bloody scratches all over his face. He denies everything. And it is uncertain whether this amounted to anything either. But again, it's quite compelling that he had physical marks all over his face and was acting strange during that time.
Sounds really spooky to have someone tell you that as well.
I think also, I feel like the wood element, like kind of like campground, woods, just it's all pretty creepy and spooky.
Absolutely, yeah.
So finally, in June 2021, Worcester County District Attorney Joseph Early revealed that there was one other person that could be of interest. Francis P. Sumner, Sr., who also goes by the name of Frank. He was a registered sex offender and had over 20 pages of criminal record, so you can see that he is probably a very unsavoury character.
Mm.
The police didn't reveal exactly what connected him to the case, but said there was new information that connected him. This is what he did before. On the 9th of July 1982, Francis was convicted of an aggravated rape and kidnap from an attack he previously did in October. A young woman who would visit the auto repair shop visited one day, and this is where the attack happened. He was sentenced to concurrent sentences of 15 to 18 years on the rape charge and 9 to 10 years on the kidnapping charge. He was incarcerated many times throughout his life. He was released from prison on the 1997 to 1998, which was 2 to 3 years just before Molly's murder, and he was living in a similar area to where Molly went missing. He was found dead in his home on the 4th of May 2016, and it is thought the police are still investigating this point of call. So, obviously, he was a person of interest in June 2021. So, again, it's another person that's passed away, or there's another person that's died, and they can't question him or grill him over this particular case.
So frustrating.
It's so frustrating.
He's got history, though.
So that is the last of all of the suspects that I found so far. but I would like to like leave on the fact that this was a and still is an incredibly big case in America. It was featured on many American television shows as Unsolved Mysteries, 48 Hours, Disappeared, and America's Most Wanted. But finally, Maggie and John Bish, Molly's parents, in 2004, they set up Molly Bish Foundation in collaboration with Anna Maria College. And it's a safety program. So after all this and throughout the investigation, Molly's parents have been so good at spreading awareness, and they've made sure there's like a buddy system within Warren where no one is allowed to walk on their own. They always have to walk with a buddy. They make sure people tell each other where they're going, even if they think it's only like a small visit somewhere or it's insignificant. They absolutely make sure everybody tells everybody where they're going. And they also say that if you ever feel like there's something off, something feels funny, then it is. Trust those instincts. So they really get out there and they really spread awareness for this, which is amazing.
Yeah. Telling people to trust their gut as well, which is important.
Definitely. And I think, you know, I've seen lots of interviews with Molly's mum, Maggie, and you can just see how much she like kind of like beats herself up a little bit over the fact that she saw this creepy guy, but she said there was nothing I could do. He didn't do anything. He was just weird, sat in the car, but just the day before. But it's one of those strange cases that kind of stays with you.
He might not even be connected. She might be beating herself up, and actually it's completely irrelevant.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Because he may not be.
What's so sad, though, is that the parents may never get that closure of what exactly happened to Molly that day.
Exactly. I mean, this happened 22 years ago now, and yeah. She was just starting off her life, and they don't know now what exactly happened.
So sad.
But terribly
good
sad.
Case, and thank you for talking us through that. I'm going to do some Googling.
Thank you. Yes, please do. And all the guys, all the men in this that are the suspects are highly creepy.
Very unsavory characters.
Just so, yeah, super, super creepy. But yeah, apologies, it's a little short, this one, but it's super important for us to share this case.
Absolutely,
I think, so.
Absolutely. Do you want to share the socials so that if anyone has any thoughts on this case, they can reach out?
You can send in your own true crime or paranormal stories to our website, www.goreandguiltypodcast.com. You can also send in your true crime or paranormal stories to our email address at goreandguiltypodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on our Instagram, where we'll show pictures from the case and ask you for questions or case suggestions at goreandguiltypodcast, or follow us on Twitter at goreandguilty. If you like this case and you like the episode, then please leave a review and let us know what you think. But yeah, we thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed. Remember, we won't judge if
gore is your guilty pleasure.
Thanks, you for guys. Listening. Bye.